This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. On this segment of the program, we're going to talk about employment law, but specifically about new California employment laws for 2017. It's a mixed bag, everybody, and hang in there because, frankly, it's going to be very interesting, I think. My guests are employment law attorneys Thomas Lenz, a partner in the Cerritos, California law firm of Atkinson, Andelson, Loya, Rood, and Romo. Did I get that right?
You did.
Yeah,
good evening,
Chuck. Pronounced right. Good. And Scott Stillman, senior counsel in the San Francisco law firm of McGuinn, Hillsman, and Pulepsky. Funding for this segment of Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar of California. Additional funding for the program is provided by the California Board of Legal Specialization, the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, and the National Board of Trial Advocacy. Well, Scott, I wonder if you'd get us started. It's my understanding, not being an employment lawyer, that one of the new laws is expanding the Equal Pay Act. What does that mean?
Yeah, that's right, Chuck.
What does it mean?
Well, it means that we're going to be pretty happy to be living in California, I think, as workers now, especially in light of the most recent election. We heard last year that the legislature amended the Equal Pay Act to address the gender wage inequality. And the Equal Pay Act, though, it's not the wage gap is not confined just to gender. Mm-hmm. In fact, an African-American male makes 75% less on average than the salary of a white man. And so what surprisingly, the Equal Pay Act, which has been on the books for 65 years, did not address race and ethnicity.
Oh my.
So finally, the legislature has gotten around to fixing that, and they've amended the Equal Pay Act to now say that an employer cannot pay less wages to a worker of a different race. So basically trying to make sure that there is equal pay for equal work and you're not making pay decisions based on somebody's race or ethnicity.
How does the Equal Pay Act, this new amendment, how does that affect women, if at all?
Well, it's going to last year was kind of the biggest amendments to the Equal Pay Act as far as affecting women. And I think in a little bit, too, we'll talk about another amendment to this Equal Pay Act, which does also deal with women. But if I can for a second to
Please.
Stay on the race and ethnicity, it's going to be the employer's burden to show that if there is a difference between somebody's pay for doing substantially similar work, and that's a key part of this too, is it's going to be the employer's burden to show that the decision to pay somebody of different races a different amount is based on something other than race. So that would be something like a seniority system or some merit system or some other kind of bona fide decision other than race, such as education. You know, if you need a professional degree to do the job, then that's going to be something that the law says, well, yeah, it's okay to pay somebody differently for those reasons.
Tom, what thoughts do you have from the employer's standpoint that depending on how an employer deals with this might create a problem?
Well, I think that many employers tend to be informal in their pay practices. They might have time cards, they might have payroll records, generally speaking, to comply with the wage and hour laws, but maybe they don't articulate their standards in writing, they don't have job descriptions, they don't spend enough time really thinking conceptually about how one job could be substantially similar to another. The framework has historically been, are the jobs identical? Yeah, when you're comparing pay discrimination situations, but the legal standard, particularly under the enactment last year, is that if jobs are substantially similar, so not identical, they could still be the basis for discrimination. So I think people need to be thinking about formalizing their requirements, following the formalities that they create so that you don't have inconsistencies.
When you say formalizing by having some kind of a booklet that is available to all employees as well as management, or what?
It's about having job descriptions.
Uh-huh.
It's about having statistics that they can refer back to on whether they are treating people in various departments and job categories in ways that can be compared and in ways where there are not disparities.
Certainly, I would think. It sounds to me, and please, I'm not trying to poo-poo this, but it sounds like it's going to be kind of like a can of worms.
Well, it will certainly inspire litigation.
Well, that's that's not something that I am in favor of. When you say it's going to inspire litigation, give us an example of what you think may happen.
There are going to be employers who either are not prepared because they're not aware of these new standards, and there will be employers who will just roll the dice see whether they
can get away with it, huh?
Exactly.
So it sounds to me, if you as an employer don't want to be served with a summons and complaint in civil court, you probably need to review this with your counsel. And if you don't have a lawyer, an employment lawyer who represents employers, you need to think seriously about doing that. Am I right or not?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's important to audit your own workplace practices, whether it's pay or your policies, your training, whatever it might be, mm-hmm. to ensure that you are keeping up with the current standards.
Yeah. And I'll say from an employee perspective,
because you represent employees in your firm, Scott.
That is correct.
And Tom, you represent employers in your firm.
Yes.
Okay, all right.
I think from the employee's perspective, you're often in a tough position because wages aren't often transparent. But if you do believe that you are being paid less for doing the substantially similar work, you do have a couple avenues. I mean, you've touched upon a potential civil complaint, but there's also the Labor Commissioner. And
California Labor
Commissioner. Labor Commissioner, who claims can be brought to and investigated from there. So that is another resource that people can go to if they do feel that there is some type of inequality happening.
Is there now? I understand that there's something here with another one of the amendments that deals with the issue of prior salary and the wage gap. Now, what does that mean, and what's the problem there, if any?
Well,
Scott, yeah.
Well, as I touched on, as far as last year's amendments to the Equal Pay Act, it really was meant to address this wage gap between men and women. We know that exists. I mean, on California women lose about $37 billion per year due to this wage gap. So this is real money that could be going to families, that could be spent on goods and services that really do help drive California's economy. So especially when you have mothers who might be the primary breadwinner in a family, or that's around 40% of California's families, that's the case. So it's a big deal, and you have this gap that's out there between men and women, and the Equal Pay Act last year kind of tried to help fix that. But one thing that it failed to address was the idea of prior salary history for women. So there is one study that came out that showed women in their first job out of college are making 82% less mm-hmm. than their male counterparts. And so that's a situation that is controlling for age and family responsibility and education levels. And even when you control for those things, from the very jump, women are getting paid significantly less. So if you then track that over time, you can see how a woman kind of gets paid less at each job, such that when she applies for a job, if the employer is using prior salary history, well, then the employer is just going to be perpetuating the same gender bias that's been taking place. So what this law did is it said it's a discriminatory act to say, I'm going to make your salary based solely on your prior salary history.
So that is a a position that an employee's attorney would find as discrimination against that particular employee by the employer. Is that right?
Right. If you said, I'm going to just look at your prior salary history and I'm going to make a decision to pay you X amount based on that salary history, and you're a woman, that's now going to be a discriminatory act under this new law that's going to go into effect January 1, 2017.
Tom, when employers are interviewing prospective employees for a job starting in 2017, do the employers have to be careful in terms of what questions they ask the prospective employees, such as, what were you making in your last job? What were you making in the year before that? Or are there things that employers have to be very careful about?
Well, there are certain questions that employers would generally want to avoid asking, things that relate to protected categories. Are you disabled? And things along those lines.
Yes.
But as it relates to past earnings and salary expectations, I think that those questions remain fair game.
Really? Okay.
But where the problem arises is when you look at practice, and is the information that the employer is gleaning from these questions being used to prejudice an employee? If you are asking about past earnings and using that to limit someone's ability to earn as compared to others in the same workforce, that is where I think the real crux of this issue is.
What kind of a question would an employer be asking a prospective employee? Can you give us an example of what a question might be that is really suspect?
I think on the issue of wages or
on the issue of a prior salary, for example.
I think it would be more than a question. If you're asking, let's say you're hiring for a position, this will be a pretty obvious example. You're hiring for a position that's $100,000 a year, and you ask someone what they've earned in the past, and they tell you, I've earned 60, mm-hmm. and you are only willing to pay them 60,
mm-hmm.
and everybody else who's doing substantially similar work is making $100,000. There you have, I think, a fairly blatant case of discrimination.
Do you? Okay.
By confining someone to earnings based upon their past. You're trapping them in their past and preventing them from getting into the mainstream of pay within your organization. So I think it's a matter of not just an inquiry. That can be a legitimate inquiry because you're, I think, mm-hmm. as an employer looking at expectations, you want to make sure that someone you hire is going to be a fit. And if someone maybe is expecting more than what you're willing to pay, you want to know that too.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's going to be a matter of your actions as well as your words in terms of how you treat that individual as compared to others.
Scott, do you have any input on that one?
Yeah, I think it's tricky because you really don't want to go down this slippery slope of starting to get into questioning or making decisions based on information that really does kind of reflect this widespread gender-based wage gap.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's really important for employers to keep a focus on what the qualifications for that job are, what the job position really entails, and really keeping your focus there as opposed to trying to, like Tom said, lock somebody into what their past is.
Okay, I want to tell you something very briefly, everyone. On Wednesday, December 28th at 7 p.m. Pacific time, we'll have our regular monthly Call a Lawyer night, which we've done for many, many years, but I want those of you who may not be familiar with it to know about this. When you can talk with attorneys off the air in several areas of law, no charge. This is a public service these attorneys perform. They're in the conference room here at the station, KLW. We'll have maybe 5, 6, 7 attorneys. And if you're not even able to hear the live program, I invite you to call in if you have a legal question call in for Call a Lawyer. And here's the number you might want to jot it down, 800-525-9917, 800-525-9917. And here is another one I'd like you to note, please. On Wednesday, January 11th at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, we'll do a special immigration law program and also a Call a Lawyer night when we'll have several immigration attorneys in the conference room taking your calls off the air. So this is something I invite you to, whether you listen to the live program or not, you're welcome to call in. And that number, 800-525-9917. Now, what about minimum wage, Scott? What's the situation with minimum wage with the new law, which I understand SB 3 increases the state minimum wage incrementally to $15 per hour by 2022, or for businesses with 25 employees or less by 2023?
Yeah, so let me kind of set the context.
Please,
for,
if you would.
Because the minimum wage is kind of a hot topic always.
It is,
and,
I'll say.
And let me, just in setting the stage for why an adjustment to the minimum wage I think was necessary statewide, it's important to realize that an employee who is working full-time 40 hours a week at the minimum wage for California, $10.50 an hour, was making less than $21,000 for the year. So
that's a $10.50 an hour.
That's a $10.50 an hour. So, I mean, when you put it in that context, you really begin to see that somebody working full time, you know, what we all are supposed to aspire to do, could be getting paid less than $21,000 for the year. On top of that, a recent study found that if you adjust the current minimum wage for inflation,
yes,
it's basically the equivalent of what the minimum wage was in 1988. So this sort of, I think, is the reason why the legislature felt this is a time, excuse me, that we need to act. So the legislature was kind of faced with this question, should we create a schedule to increase the minimum wage on an incremental basis? And they said yes.
Mm-hmm. But that seems, here's 2016, the end of 2016, so it's incrementally, it'll be increased to $15 an hour by 2022. How much is it increased? Do you know how much it's increased every year of these, let's say, what will be 5 years until 2022, starting in 2017?
Yeah, it starts off with, I think, a 50 cent increase.
50 cents, so that's $11 an hour.
Yeah, and then it goes up by year by $1. An important caveat, too, is for small businesses, like you said, for 25 who have 25 or fewer employees, they get an extra year, so it won't go up to $15 for them until 2023.
Wow.
So I know it, you know, it still is a small amount, but I got to tell you, it is going to result in a raise for 6 million workers in California, which is about one third of the working population.
I'm glad to hear that it is going to be of some help. Tom, obviously, though, there are cities and counties that are doing passing ordinances with much higher or greater increases in hourly rates. What comments do you have about this from the employer standpoint? And I know that you're a man who's incredibly fair and very thoughtful about this whole thing, both from the employer standpoint as well as the employee standpoint. What are the pitfalls here with someone who may be working in San Francisco, but then they'll move to Walnut Creek or somewhere else to do work there? Are they going to be hit with not just the California hourly rate, but the San Francisco rate, the Walnut Creek rate, or whatever it is?
Well, this is an amazing development in California law, and the importance of minimum wage has just skyrocketed. The attention it's received is significant for good reason. As Scott mentioned, the minimum wage will be rising in tiers to $15. And, of course, Seattle took the big plunge going to $15 directly. And I think that California was inspired by that Seattle example. And a number of localities across the state have, through ordinances, implemented their own minimum wages, which are really super minimum wages. So you have a situation where an employer needs not only to comply with state law, but needs to be mindful of the area or areas in which that employer operates. So if you're in
Give us a simple example.
Sure.
What you're talking about?
If you're in Fresno, your minimum wage will be $10.50.
Okay.
If you are in San Francisco, your current minimum wage is $13.
Uh-huh.
And it will increase on July 1 of 2017 to $14. If you are, let's say, in Los Angeles, your current minimum wage is already $10.50, and you'll be going up in July of 2017 to $12 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a patchwork going on, and you need to be mindful of what the rules are wherever you are. Pasadena, where I spend some time, it has a minimum wage. That's Southern California. Of course, Berkeley, El Cerrito, Emeryville, Mountain View, Palo Alto, Richmond. These are some of the areas that, that have implemented their own minimum wage rules. And so let's say you're...
And that would control with an employee who's working in that area, as opposed, even if it's higher than the state minimum of $10.50, that would control that that's what that employee should be paid per hour. Is that right?
Yes. It'll depend on how each ordinance is written. Let's say you're Domino's Pizza and you have shops in various parts of the Bay Area. You could have different minimum wage rates applying to your operations, depending on the city, even though you may think you have a uniform wage rate company-wide. And I use that as an example, not that I know details of their operations. But let's say you're a construction contractor and you are based in, let's say, Walnut Creek, and you have employees who are moving from place to place doing different types of work. You could be subject to San Francisco rates one day, Berkeley rates another day, depending upon where your work is.
I see. So this is a potential real can of worms.
And yes, an employer who's not paying attention to those details and paying the appropriate rate could, you know, face some significant exposure.
Is there some kind of significant penalty if an employer doesn't pay enough attention or intentionally doesn't follow, let's say, what should be paid to the employee in a certain area? Is this law, does it have some kind of penalty to it?
It will vary from one ordinance to another, but under California law, you have a variety of repercussions, which include not only the unpaid wage, but potentially penalties, what's referred to as waiting time.
What does that mean?
Waiting time, if there is a willful failure to pay wages that are owed, an employer could be liable for up to 30 days of pay.
Really?
Beyond.
Wow.
So that's
California law.
Yeah. So let's say you weren't paid overtime one day and you make a claim and your employer says, no, I'm not going to pay you for that amount that I owe you. You could literally, on top of that one day's worth of overtime, be entitled to 30 days of pay.
Wow. Well, there you are, everybody.
Yeah.
Mark down. Keep notes of what you're doing if you're employed and you're entitled to some overtime.
And again, I think that's also where the Labor Commissioner's Office can come into play, too. That's another resource that workers who were not paid the minimum wage can go and seek. Another wrinkle to this minimum wage law is, for the first time ever in California history, the minimum wage after 2022, when it becomes $15 an hour, it'll be tied to the consumer price index. Essentially,
that's the national consumer price index.
Right.
Is that right?
Essentially, it's now going to be tied to inflation and rise accordingly.
I see.
Like a lot of several other states have that. Mm-hmm. And why I think that's important, number one, we won't see these just on one random year the legislature decides we want to do something on the minimum wage, which can be trouble for businesses and families trying to plan for the upcoming years. When you have it on a schedule like this, then the business and the family can plan their budgets accordingly, mm-hmm. which I think is really helpful and will be something that is very different from years past.
We have about 2 minutes left in the statewide version of the program, which is a half an hour, which is recorded and sent out to 15 other stations in California. We of course, are doing a live program and will continue for a full hour, second half hours, when I will invite you to call in and ask questions. Do we have time for you to talk briefly about choice of law and choice of venue clauses? We have actually have 2 minutes, Tom, on this.
Thanks, Chuck. On choice of law and choice of venue, this is an important issue because many times employers will have employment agreements which will they will try to enforce with employees in California. An employer, perhaps one who's based outside the state of California, might have language to say that this agreement is governed by the law of Texas. Or Florida, or some other state, or wherever that employer might happen to be based. It might say that if a claim is to be made, it is to be made in the courts of Florida or Texas or whichever state happens to be named. And the purpose of this law is to say, hey, wait a minute, you're in California. And if you have an employment agreement, you're going to follow California law. Your claims are going to be brought in California court. You're not dragging people into faraway places with unfamiliar rules.
Scott, do you have something to say on that?
Yeah, this bill actually came out of a series of bills that dealt with mandatory arbitration, and this, unfortunately, was the only one that passed. But you see a lot of these choice of venue, choice of law provisions in mandatory arbitration clauses. And a quick caveat on mandatory arbitration, I really think it's a cancer in our justice system. I think it's set up to be this separate but equal system, and really it's separate and not equal. And I think
why do you say it's separate but not equal?
I think that employees lose a lot of rights when they go into mandatory arbitration. I think that a lot of employees are having to agree to these clauses at the beginning of their job when they lack any ability to negotiate that clause. So I don't think arbitration is necessarily a bad thing, but when it's mandatory as opposed to some voluntary process, I think that's where you get into the problem.
Of course, we as employees can't question if an employer has that as mandatory, but we'll talk about that later. All right, everybody, let me give you the toll-free number in case you have a question about employment law. We will continue for another half hour. It's toll-free, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Pardon me. Support for KLW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you have a legal problem, you may need to talk to a lawyer. The San Francisco Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange an appointment for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation in both San Francisco and Marin County. For a referral to a lawyer or the Bay Area Mediation Services of the San Francisco Bar, call 415-989-1616. That's 415-989-1616. If you're in San Mateo County, the San Mateo County Bar Association also has a lawyer referral service. That number is 650-369-4149, 650-369-4149. Everywhere in California, every county in California has a bar association and a lawyer referral service. It's a great service, by the way. You call your own during normal business hours, tell them what the problem is. They'll do their best to find someone who's experienced, that is an attorney who's experienced, to talk with you for half an hour. And with minor exception in California, you will pay for a half an hour consultation somewhere between $25 to $35. This does not go to the attorney. It goes to the lawyer referral service to keep it going. It's an outstanding service. Additional funding for your legal rights is made possible by the Family Law Section of the State Bar of California, the Trust and Estate Section of the State Bar, the California Applicants Attorneys Association, and the San Mateo County Bar Association. And for those of you who may have tuned in a little bit late, this is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. We're doing a program on new California employment laws for 2017. If you have a question in the employment law area, whether you're an employer or an employee, join us, please. We're doing this program live on Wednesday, December 21st, 2016, everybody. The toll-free number, 866-798-8255. So if you get this program delayed and you hear this number, other than on the day of December 21st, you ain't going to get us. Okay, my guests are employment law attorneys Scott Stillman, who's a senior counsel in the San Francisco law firm of McGuinn, Hilsman, and Pilepsky, and Thomas Lenz, a partner in the Cerritos, California law firm of Atkinson, Andelson, Loya, Rood, and Romo. You have a couple of other offices. You have one in Pleasanton.
We do.
And where else? Is that it?
Sacramento, Fresno, Cerritos, Pasadena, Irvine, San Diego. And we are soon to be opening in Marin County.
My goodness. Wow. Well, then I'll see more of you.
Yes.
Probably. All right. So here we are, everybody. We're going to take our first call, and the first call is going to be Steve. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you very much.
This Hi.
This is a great call and a great program, especially around this time of year.
I'll say, Steve. Go ahead.
A question for our panelists over there. What if there was a company where they got a bad reputation and then all their employees who were maybe going to try to find jobs elsewhere were not able to find jobs because it was tarnished, or if they did find jobs, it was at lower pay? Has there ever been some kind of a class action type of a lawsuit where it's been based on the impairment of their human capital, say? Does that make any sense?
Does it make any sense?
Yes.
Scott, do you want to respond to
yes.
Steve? Steve, if you'll turn your radio back up, thank
Will
you very
do.
Much. Thanks for calling.
Off the air.
Happy holidays, Steve.
Happy holidays, guys.
Nice to hear from you.
Well, thanks for the call and question, Steve. I can't say that any case law comes to mind off of that. I will say that it can be, especially at this time, and I see it as somebody who represents employees, there's a lot of terminations that happen at the end of the year, unfortunately. There's a lot of people who may not get the bonus that they wanted paid or that they believe they deserve to be paid. And so it can be a really, I think, tough time for a lot of employees right now. And
why is it picked at the end of the year that they let people go? Is there any particular reason for that?
Well, I think that budgets can typically happen, on a calendar year. I think that also it's become commonplace for bonuses to be determined and paid around these times.
I see. Tom, do you have any comments on that?
No, I think that I would just append to Scott's comments that the end of the year tends to be an interesting time. It's a time of evaluations. It's a time of bonuses and raises, and I think a lot of customary expectations, not all of which are fulfilled, and many times transitions are made. Sometimes,
including you don't have a job anymore.
Right. It could be the employer transitions someone out. It could be the employee transitions out, staying long enough to receive that end of year bonus.
I see.
So there's a variety of things.
And if I could just comment,
go ahead, Scott.
Also.
Yeah.
One thing that, I don't know, may be helpful to Steve is there are sites out there, like Glassdoor is one of them, where people...
Glassdoor?
Glassdoor, and it's basically where employees or people from the company can post different things about what it was like to work there and various things. So I think the purpose of it is to help people who are applying to jobs figure out what is the culture at this company. Is it someplace that I would want to work? And so when Steve is asking about a company maybe with a bad reputation or whatnot,
this is there.
This is around and is something that can be checked out as you do kind of apply for jobs.
So this can be Google Glassdoor?
Yes.
GLASS, second word, DOOR?
That's
that right?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes,
well, there you
website.
Are, Steve. Steve, I hope this is of some help to you. Our toll-free number, 866-798-8255 for Your Legal Rights. John, welcome to the program.
Oh, good. Thank you very much. How are you doing this evening?
Okay. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate talking to you, gentlemen. I will say that I am very disappointed and disillusioned that in all of this hype and talk about wages, the one group I have not heard discussed at all is the disabled. And I will tell you that as a long-term disabled person, we have been discriminated against wage-wise for years. And as a matter of fact, I have a long-standing issue. I worked for a county, and it was very simple. I'm a blind person. It was very simple. I was not allowed to promote because I was blind. And that was years ago. But I don't see this changing. And it would appear that discrimination against the disabled is still permissible.
Well, let me get some comments for you, John, because my reaction to that is, if you have been discriminated against because you're blind, but you could do the job otherwise, and I know there are ways that you can do this, that could be a violation of the Americans with Disabilities Act. So let me get some comments for you. Thank you very much for calling, by the way.
You.
Turn your radio back up. Scott, do you have some comments for John?
Yeah, I do think that California is a state where we do have really strong disability discrimination laws. There is definitely stuff on the books as to not being able to discriminate against somebody because of their disabled. I think, though, where I totally agree with John is in the fact that the Equal Pay Act does not address disability. It does not address the LGBTQ community either. And so I think that just like you saw last year, the Equal Pay Act was amended to address, the gender wage gap. This year, it was trying to address the race and ethnicity. My hope is that the legislature continues to move forward and make the law address the disabled community and the LGBTQ community.
Tom, please.
Yes, I think that this is an important question, because when there are laws that specify certain protected categories, there can easily be a read of that other categories are left out. As Chuck mentioned, there is the Americans with Disabilities Act, there is the Fair Employment and Housing Act, and there are enforcement mechanisms either through private action, meaning lawsuits, or going to the administrative agencies like Equal Employment Opportunity Commission or Department of Fair Employment and Housing,
which is a state agency.
Correct.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where you can raise claims like that. But I think to the extent that there are new laws that address these standards, it is certainly, I think, timing in California, which is fortuitous. I would look at it, if you're an employee and you're looking to expand the law, I think it's perhaps a time of opportunity to reach out and to mention, the issue you've raised. I think that this legislature, this governor, may well listen to that and may be interested in what you have to say. From the employee side of things, I have to, thank you for your call. And as the father of someone who's disabled, this is of great importance to me in making sure that there are opportunities for people who are disabled and in the workforce. As an advocate for employers, I look at this in terms of, I don't want the employers I work with making distinctions based purely on disability. I want people to be that I advise and that I represent making decisions based upon legal criteria such as essential functions of the job and ability to do the essential functions with or without an appropriate accommodation.
Well, it's not only complying with the law, but it's also ethical and morally proper to do so.
And I think it's about inclusion and helping people, whoever they are, whatever their skill set may be, to be in the workforce and to have gainful employment. I think that should be a goal for everyone.
I think it should be. Let me mention a couple of things for those of you down in who are in the San Francisco Bay Area, and this relates to the San Mateo County Law Library in Redwood City. On Wednesday, January 4th, you might want to jot this down, at 12 to noon, noon to 1 p.m., there will be a free lecture on how to clean up your criminal record. Certified specialist in criminal law, attorney Christopher Morales, will discuss various ways to clean up a criminal record, including even how to obtain a certificate of rehabilitation and the steps necessary to apply for a pardon from the governor or president. You're invited to attend this free free lecture at the law library. You can bring your sack lunch. It's located at 710 Hamilton Street in Redwood City. That's Wednesday, January 4th at noon till 1. If you'd like more information, it's 650-363-4913, 650-363-4913. And also the library, the San Mateo County Law Library, in conjunction with Bay Area Legal Aid, every Monday at 10 a.m., has a consumer law clinic. So if you need some help with a collection case or something, this is free information where lawyers who are connected with the Bay Area Legal Aid will be there at the library at 710 Hamilton Street. But if you want to do that, you need to make a reservation. And that number, which you might want to jot down, 650-358-0745. 650-358-0745. That's a great service that the library and the Bay Area Legal Aid are performing. I hope you can take advantage of it if you need it. Denise, welcome to Your Legal Rights. Are you there, Denise? Have we lost you, Denise?
No, I'm here. Thanks.
Well, good, dear. You're on the air. You got it. Go ahead.
Yeah, I got a phone call from my employee, my manager, let's say, who just was telling me, who was telling me that my position was being eliminated.
How recent did you get the call?
Well, this was about a month ago.
Okay, all right.
My question is now I am represented by union, but I was just wondering if there's any of the labor law area that I need to address also.
You don't have a written contract of employment, do you, Denise?
Would that be when I apply for the job that would?
If they had represented to you that this position would last for a certain period of time, that I would interpret as a consumer advocate would be a contract. I'm just wondering if there was anything in writing as to how long you would be there.
No, this was a permanent position. This was a permanent position. I'm a nurse, so it's a permanent nursing position.
And you are a member of a union, is that correct?
Correct.
And have you contacted your union to see if they can help you on this?
I have. Okay. I have.
And are they helping you or not?
Well, they are, but my question was just if there was anything anything else I needed to look for as far as the labor part of it.
Tom Lenz has a response for you.
Sure. Okay. Hi, Denise. I would suggest that you get a copy of your collective bargaining agreement. If you are union represented and they have negotiated an agreement, it should spell out the terms for your employment, and that would include things such as discipline and discharge. Under most collective bargaining agreements, there is a grievance procedure, and if issues are not resolved between the parties, they can be addressed in arbitration. And then what the details of those issues are may depend upon the facts of your employment and how you were released, and your rights might also be spelled out by that agreement. The courts will largely give force to those agreements and the grievance arbitration process to work things out. But sometimes, and this is important to know, those collective bargaining agreements may provide non-discrimination clauses. They may say that this agreement intends to cover claims under certain laws outside of the agreement. So it could be a variety of discrimination laws. And that, in turn, could give you some, I think, idea of the scope of what you can do through the union. And because you are union represented, the union has a legal duty, what's called a duty of fair representation, to represent you. They do have some leeway in how they follow and pursue that duty, but at the same time, you are entitled to be treated in a fair and non-discriminatory way in their investigation and pursuit of a grievance.
Denise, let me ask you this. This is Chuck.
Yeah.
Have you sought the legal advice of an attorney at this point?
I have not. I haven't gone through the union.
Do you have a pen or pencil and a piece of paper?
I do.
All right. You know, I see that you are in San Francisco, and my recommendation to you, being a consumer advocate that I am, I think you should contact the San Francisco Lawyer Referral Service, and I'll give you the phone number, 415-989-1616. Uh-huh. Yep. 415-989-1616. I think you should call them, and I think you should ask if you can have an appointment with an employment law attorney who represents employees for half an hour and have a chance to learn something about what, by face-to-face or nose-to-nose with an experienced employment lawyer, what your rights may be. So as Tom has suggested, get a copy of the collective bargaining agreement. You should be able to get that without a big problem. And then I think if I were you, I would want to seek the advice, even though it may only be half an hour, of an employment lawyer who represents employees. And good luck to you.
Thank you, Chuck.
Okay.
I would add that if you can gather together any information, any documents on your employment and the your release from employment, as well as to take notes of what happened, when you began, if there were any situations, incidents, what was said in the phone call, things like that, because those sorts of details over time can fade in your memory, and having notes like that, being able to refer back to notes like that, can be very effective in refreshing your recollection.
Yeah, you need to document it. Well, good luck to you, Denise.
Thank you.
I hope you have a decent holiday season. Thank you very much for calling.
Thank you.
We have time for another call or two. Let me just mention to you all that this entire program, the entire hour, we do an hour, of course, live, but the entire program is available free as a podcast at www.kalw.org/RSS if you'd like to hear the entire hour. I think it's a very valuable service that KLW provides. Matthew, welcome to your legal rights.
Hello. And so I was hoping that you could address or define for me wrongful termination. And if I feel that I come under that heading, what maybe three main steps I should take to address this? I've done something myself, but I would just like to hear what you have to say. So again, if you could define wrongful termination.
This is a big, big field, Matthew. Have you sought the advice of a lawyer yet?
No, and do you think that I should?
Because yes, I do. I do. Yes. Listen.
Can I tell you one thing that I've done, though?
Okay, go ahead.
This might be helpful for your listeners.
Sure.
I spoke to the people at the Department of Fair Labor and Housing.
Ah.
They sent me paperwork. I sent the paperwork back completed. They sent it back to me saying that they needed dates. It seems to me that that's a very complicated way to define wrongful termination or discrimination or harassment in the workplace, because if you need incredibly specific dates, I mean, almost no one will be able to comply with that, because, I mean, no one goes to work paranoid taking down dates so that they can later say, this is why I was terminated. So if you could, so I've spoken to those people, and I felt totally frustrated with the experience, because again, when they come back and say, we need dates, well, what does that mean after?
Let me get some input from you. But as I did with Denise, since I think you are calling from San Francisco,
I am.
You need to also contact the San Francisco Bar's Lawyer Referral Service and at least give yourself the benefit of speaking to an employment law attorney who represents employees, so at least you have some idea of what your rights may be. And I think with San Francisco, the Lawyer Referral Service, I think it's only $35. The money does not go to the lawyer, it goes to the Lawyer Referral Service. So whatever you do and whatever my guests say, because with a limited amount of time that we have, frankly, I've been a lawyer for a long, long time. You want much more than what my guests are able to tell you on the radio program. So turn your radio back up, and I'll get you some comments. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Scott, please.
Right. So wrongful termination is definitely, it's a big topic, but I think if we're going to try to boil it down, and a really important piece of it is there's a whole second half of the legal claim. It's wrongful termination in violation of a public policy. So if you're going to bring a claim for wrongful termination, it's got to be tied to some public policy that's on the books.
Give us an example.
So an example is some type of law or even case law can count as public policy. So, for instance, we've talked tonight about, say, disability discrimination. So if somebody was terminated and the reason behind that termination, the motivation for the termination was because of that person's disability.
Yeah.
Well, California has a law on the books that says you can't discriminate against somebody for their disability. So California has a public policy that says you can't do this. So if the motivation behind the termination is for because of their disability, then you may have a claim for wrongful termination in violation of public policy. But most workers in the state are going to be at-will employees, which means they can be fired for
any
reason or no reason at all. Just the key is that the motivation behind the termination is not for some type of public policy that California has said, look, even if you're an at-will employee, you can't be terminated if the motivation is because of that.
If it's a racial termination because of a race, racial issue, or ethnicity, or religious purpose, person.
Right. It's all those kind of protected classes that we've heard of. If your gender, your race, your ethnicity, religion, or if you're a whistleblower, if you have objected to something that you believe to be illegal and you think, you know, the company fired me because I objected to something I believe to be illegal, that could be the basis for a wrongful termination in violation for public policy.
You know, Matthew, this is the wrongful termination and a violation of public policy is such a very, very, very broad area that you really owe it to yourself to at least get face-to-face with an employment lawyer who represents employees for at least half an hour, frankly. It's a great investment on your part. And if you don't do this, don't listen to this program ever again. And I'm kind of pulling your chain, but I mean, listen, I'm trying to help you avoid problems, and I'm trying to give you some direction to go in the right direction. So, Scott, I know you had something.
Yeah, I think one thing we often forget about when we analyze a situation is there's the basically two boxes I think that you'd ever want to check off if you were going to be if it was worth it to bring a lawsuit. And you know, the first one is, was there a legal violation? That's kind of what we've been talking about. Was he wrongfully terminated in violation of public policy? But the second box that you'd really want to check off is, what are the damages for that?
Sure.
What have you suffered, and is it worth it to put yourself you know, out there on a lawsuit? And so I think in the case of a wrongful termination, what people should understand is you have a duty to go look for a next job, and in order to collect front pay.
There is a duty to do that.
There's a duty to go look for a next job. So you can't be wrongfully terminated and then kind of sit back and do nothing and then try to collect front pay. So it's very important that people who have been terminated, although it is extremely emotionally distressing. I mean, psychologists have done studies where it ranks up there with life traumas such as death in the family and divorce.
Sure.
You know, a wrongful termination does. But you got to get back out there and start looking for a job if you are going to collect front pay.
Tom, I know you had something.
Yes, I would add to this discussion that anytime you're looking at a claim of wrongful termination, you are looking at, when did wrongful conduct occur? And if so, if there was wrongful conduct, what is the applicable statute of limitation? There are a variety of different laws that apply to the workplace, and each of them has a different life period. So if something happened longer ago than the limitation period would allow, you may have had something unlawful happen, but you're not pursuing it in the appropriate period of time, and therefore you're not entitled to relief. So the dates are very important. I mean, this is a very detail-oriented thing, and if you are bringing a claim, and this is something I will bring up all the time in defense of employers, that the employee often has the burden of proof.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't meet your burden, I'm going to ask the judge or the agency or whoever it is to dismiss that claim. So I think that whether it's a plaintiff's attorney or a government agency, and you know, I used to be a government investigator at the National Labor Relations Board, I would always want to know when things happen, because that sets a framework for the set of facts that follow, and whether it's something that we can do anything about, as well as, you know, how much money, if any, is this person entitled to in the event of unlawful conduct.
So I think one of the things, Matthew, that certainly Tom is talking about and that I would want you to do is do your best in terms of when you've been asked to come back with when did this happen, when did that happen, et cetera, dates. I think you need to do your best to try to at least approximate when something went wrong or something that you feel has something to do with this. It's going to be to your benefit if you can kind of concentrate on this and try to recollect what the situation is. Scott, did you have something further on this?
I guess one other thing that I would say is important is basically if you're going to be out there kind of looking for your next job, then it's a really important thing to do also for unemployment insurance purposes too, because a lot of people like Denise, who called earlier, who has been laid off, she would be eligible for unemployment insurance, and that's something that, you know, we've all as workers have been paying into, and it's something you're entitled to. So when you have been terminated, that is something to explore.
Yeah. Anything else, Tom? We have about 1 minute left.
Now, I think just the more precise you can be, the better. You have the burden, and a judge, an administrative agency, will expect you to put forth those details. And any vagueness, any holes in your case, you should expect that those holes will be attacked by the fact finder or your opponent.
Don't give them, Matthew and everybody else, don't give them any holes. Don't do it. Do your best to try to recollect what the situation is so you can supply this to the agency you're dealing with or to a lawyer when you go and have an initial consultation. All right, 30 seconds left. Scott, you've got it.
Well, one thing I'll say is you can find a lot more information about all the stuff that we talked about, especially in particular regards to the law, the new laws we talked about at it's leginfo.ca.gov, which is leginfo.ca.gov. And that has all the bills we talked about and the bill history, too.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. And before I tell you who has been here, again, I want to repeat for you, this entire hour is available as a podcast free of charge at www.kalw.org/RSS. Thank you, gentlemen. Great to see both of you. Employment law attorney Tom Lenz, who's a partner in the Cerritos, California law firm of Atkinson, Andelson, Lawyer Rood, and Romo. And Scott Stillman, senior counsel in the San Francisco law firm of McGuinn, Hillsman, and Palestri. I think they're both outstanding lawyers. And thank you, gentlemen, for this. We'll
thank
do another
you,
program on other changes in the law, so don't give up, everybody. Next time on Your Legal Rights is our Scam Alert program and how you can protect yourself from fraudsters and scammers. My guest is Jay White, an attorney with the Legal Aid Society of San Mateo County, California. Your Legal Rights production staff members are program engineer Joanne Marr and production assistant Martin McLean. Funding for this segment of Your Legal Rights was made possible by the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar of California. Additional funding for the program is made possible by the National Board of Trial Advocacy, which also funds the public radio satellite transmission of the program for national distribution. Yes, we are national on a small level, but we're doing the best. We're trying to get the word out. Thank you for joining us on Your Legal Rights Public Radio, and please join us next time on your public radio station. Happy holidays, everybody. I'm Chuck Finney. Uh-huh.